and welcome back to Franklin Covey's twice weekly leadership podcast. On Leadership with Scott Miller, I'm your host each week, 6 years, 350 plus episodes. Such a delight to be able to bring the power of Franklin Covey, the world's most trusted leadership firm, into your lives, your homes, your offices, your communities each week, where we shine what is our mega bright spotlight onto people that we think have made the world a better place. Perhaps they are corporate CEOs, philanthropic leaders, educators, volunteers, people that have perhaps suffered tragedies in life that are bold enough and courageous enough to share their stories with you, all in the hopes of making you a better leader, however you define leadership in the many roles you have in life. Today is a guest we are featuring that I have been chasing since we opened this podcast. There were five guests that I wanted to land. People like Brené Brown, check, and David Goggins, soon to be check, and Jay Shetty and others. And I have been chasing this gentleman for 6 years. He hasn't been avoiding it. I'm going to guess he didn't know I was chasing him. But, you know, people of his stature have lots of inquiries. And I'll have to tell you, I'm super honored today to be featuring Pastor Rick Warren on Franklin Covey's podcast. As you know, we are a global public company. We don't advocate any particular style of life other than living your life in alignment with natural principles that govern everyone in life, no matter what country or culture or company or religion or faith journey you may or may not be on. We like to surface principles of effectiveness, which was Dr. Covey's guiding vision. To give you some sense, Dr. Covey's book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, has sold about 50 million copies around the world, arguably the best-selling personal leadership book of all time, eclipsed by today's gift. To give you some sense, The Purpose-Driven Life has sold over 100 million copies. According to the Guinness World Book of Record, it is the second most translated book in history, second only to the Bible, in 200 plus languages. You know this book as The Purpose-Driven Life. What on earth am I here for? The founding pastor of the Saddleback Church, Rick Warren, is here. Rick, welcome to On Leadership.
Thank you, Scott. I've read so many books of Covey leadership imprint and things like that, and you're doing a great job. You know, the bottom line is this: no matter what field you're in, leadership principles, character, perspective are all pretty much the same. I recently did a conference in Rwanda, in Kigali, Rwanda, where I actually have dual citizenship and serve on the president's cabinet. And I brought in 1,000 business leaders handpicked. I brought in 1,000 government leaders handpicked, and brought in 1,000 faith leaders handpicked, and put them all in the room and said, regardless of what you're leading, you have to learn certain skills, certain characters, certain perspectives. And so I love your show, and God bless you.
Thank you, Rick. Rick, you have transcended religion to become, I think, an iconic leader, a force for good around the world. You, of course, founded as the pastor of Saddleback Church. You have spoken to congresses and parliaments and done TED Talks. You've talked to the United Nations, Davos Economic Forum. I think you have really become a well-respected force for good around the world. Would you take a few moments and perhaps the last few people that haven't read The Purpose-Driven Life or aren't familiar with your life's work, take a few moments and just reorient your journey to all of our listeners and viewers. You started where and started doing what?
Yeah, well, you know, bottom line is everybody can live life at one of three levels: the survival level, the success level, and the significance level. Most of the world, Scott, lives at survival level. They're wondering, am I going to get my next meal? If you have any coin sitting in a little glass or cup sitting somewhere, you're wealthier than about half the population of the world. Many of them don't have a refrigerator, much less. They're wondering, where am I going to get my next meal? Will I have a roof over my head? Things like that. Nobody in America lives at the survival level because we have safety nets. Now, there are people who live at the emotional survival level, which means, how do you know when you're there? Well, you're always dreaming of going to Tahiti, if I could get away. The problem is, if you go somewhere, you take you with you, so you take your stress with you. But most people live at the success level in America. What I mean by that is you have enough money to make choices. You may not be going to the fanciest restaurant, but you can go to McDonald's or some other fast food. Money means choices, and choices means freedom to choose. So most people live at the success level. But, you know, Scott, a number of books came out in the last couple decades that basically summarize it this way. Well, if I'm so successful, why do I still feel unfulfilled? If I'm so successful, why do I feel like a fake? The imposter phenomenon is one names of one of those books. And the really the reason why, and Covey, Stephen Covey knew this, is that you're made for more than success. You are made for significance. And significance doesn't come from status. It doesn't come from sex. It doesn't come from salary. Significance actually comes from having a purpose greater than yourself, something that pulls you out of bed each day. I'm not a big enough reason to live for myself. I'm going to get bored with me pretty quickly. I need something bigger than myself to pull me out of myself and pull me to a higher level. And that is at the foundation of the purpose-driven life.
Rick, this book, incomprehensibly, that you lovingly crafted over a long period of time, has sold 100 million copies. It's been translated into more languages than there are countries in the world.
That's true. That is true.
Will you talk about your start? Because it wasn't your first book. You wrote a book similar to it that was adjacent. For all the budding authors out there, for the people who are at the feet of greatness right now, talk about how easy writing this book was for you.
It is not easy. Writing is like birthing a baby. So if you think it's going to be easy, you're just going to churn it out, then you're going to have a churned out book. Great material is not written. It's rewritten and rewritten and rewritten. And what I tell budding authors is write the first draft from the heart, but write the second draft, you know, from the head. In other words, when you're writing, you want to just kind of spill it out. Blah. You just kind of vomit it out. And you get out the ideas without working about grammar or sentence structure, or is this the most succinct way to say it? One of the things that I believe in is in simplicity in writing. It happens to be my style. There are many other styles that are appropriate. But my style, Einstein once said, you don't understand something unless you can say it in a simple way. Simple is not simplistic. Simple is not superficial. Simple is not shallow. Simple means it's clear. You understand it. And one of the reasons this book has been translated more than any other book in history is because it's easily to translate. It's translatable. And I didn't try to, I have a doctorate. I have advanced degrees. I had 6 years of Greek and Hebrew. But I'm not trying to impress people with my education. I'm not called to reach intellectual giraffes. I'm called to feed sheep and to care for normal people in normal circumstances. So I'm not profound. Now, interesting, Jesus Christ said profound things in simple ways. We do the exact opposite. We say simple things in profound ways. And a lot of times people go, wow, that was really too deep for me. And they weren't deep, they were just muddy. They weren't very clear. So it takes a lot of effort to be clear. And as I was writing that book, it took me 12 hours a day for 7 months to write the book. Yes, you heard that right. 12 hours a day for 7 months. And I pretty much, that's all I did. I got up in the morning at 4 a.m., went to a study, started typing at 5 a.m. About noon, I'd eat lunch, take a shower, walk around the campus, start typing again at 1 o'clock till 5, go home, play with the kids, eat dinner, was in bed by 8 o'clock. I was very disciplined for 7 months. And I was rewriting and rewriting and saying, if I have a 20 word sentence, how can I say it in 12? And if I got 12 words, how can I say it in 7? It's kind of like I was born for Twitter before Twitter. But when you say things succinctly, by the way, I could tell you that the publisher, when I first sent the book off, said this book will never sell. They said, it doesn't have enough stories. You might get a ghostwriter. And I said, well, that's okay. I'll just self-publish it because I believe in the content. And they said, oh, no, we'll do it. But it broke a lot of rules. There aren't a lot of stories in it because I want it to be international. I want it to be intercultural. I had stories in there that I liked a lot, but they were American stories. And they wouldn't relate in Bhutan or Botswana or Bolivia. And so I made it more of a universal message. Now, everybody has family, so you can tell family stories. But if you're going to reach a larger market, you've got to think like that larger market.
Rick, I'd like to ask you a series of what I think are insightful questions, and perhaps have you just answer them by gleaning on all the success that you and your family have experienced. It's quite public that you and your family experienced, I'm sure, a lot of private tragedy, including the loss of your son recently. And so many people have been inspired by you and your wife's journey through that. And to the extent you're comfortable, I'd love to have you draw upon that for the many people that
I
may be
like
listening
to talk about that. That'd be
that have similar experiences. Let me pitch some questions and you kind of fill in the blanks.
Sure.
The most successful, fulfilled people think and do what?
They never stop learning. They never, never, never stop learning. All leaders are learners. The moment you stop learning, you stop leading. Growing organizations, growing companies, growing churches, growing nations require growing leaders. The moment you stop growing, your nation, your company, your country, your church stops growing. And so people say, how do you motivate other people? I just try to motivate myself. And if I'm motivated, if I'm on fire, other people will be warmed by that. And so you never stop learning. Now, you can learn from anybody if you just know the right question, Scott. Everybody's ignorant just on different subjects. I could take 100 people who are listening today, and every one of them could teach me something because I know the questions to draw it out. There's a verse in Scripture, in Proverbs, that says this: counsel in the heart of man is like a deep well, but a man of understanding will draw it out. You need to learn how to ask good questions. The quality of your life will be determined by the quality of questions you're willing to ask yourself and you're willing to ask others. Now, the problem is a lot of people would rather appear to know it all than actually know it all. I'd rather admit that I don't know it all, that everybody else knows more than me in different subjects. And if I can glean from them, if I can ask the right questions, then I grow. I actually learn from everybody. For instance, I'm a pastor. I learn from churches that are larger than Saddleback. I learn from churches that are smaller than Saddleback. I learn from people who disagree with me. I learn from my enemies. I actually learn from my critics. Why? Because all they know is what they know, but they never learn from me. But I know what I know, and I learn from them, so that makes me smarter. And they actually help you if you understand how to turn it into a learning experience. So all leaders are learners. That's the number one thing I find people, doesn't matter what your age is, whether you're 14 or 40 or, you know, heading up toward 100, you never, never, never stop learning. And you just be curious about life. If you do that, you'll keep growing. And as you keep growing, your world will keep expanding.
Rick, intended or unintended, you are arguably one of the most well-known humans of our lifetime. You don't publish a book that has sold 100 million copies in 200 languages and not have people know who you are. And as a result, on occasion, you have your trust violated. When your trust is violated, how have you learned to respond and recover?
Well, that's a great question, Scott. First, let me just say this. Never waste a second trying to be famous, because fame is fleeting. One minute you're a hero, and the next minute you're the zero. One minute you're on the cover of Rolling Stone or Time magazine, and the next minute, the very next week, somebody else is. I've got a collection of all the magazine covers I've been on. The only person who cares about them are my mother, okay? Nobody else cares that I've been on all these magazine covers. They don't even remember it. So fame is fleeting. It's worthless. And so don't spend any time on that. Invest your life. The greatest use of your life is to invest it in something that will outlast it. And I hate to tell you this, but all of people who are famous right now, in 100 years, most people aren't going to remember any of them. And one of the signs that we see in a decaying culture is that, you know, the sun is setting on a culture when small people cast large shadows. Mm-hmm. And people who really haven't done a whole lot except being famous for being famous are actually considered, you know, the great people of our age. So I wouldn't focus on fame. Now, in betrayal, I think betrayal is one of the worst and most painful experiences. There are thousands of people listening right now who've been betrayed by a spouse, or they've been betrayed by a husband or a wife or a girlfriend or a boyfriend or a parent. And all of that. And I hate to go back, but I have to give an example from the Bible where Joseph was betrayed by his brothers, and they actually sold him into slavery. Later, they don't know what's going on, but he says, well, you know what? You guys meant it for bad, but God meant it for good. Anything, any bad thing in your life can be used for good if you respond the right way. Here's the thing. You control the controllables, and you just trust God for the rest. And you control what you can control. But the fact is, most of the things in your life you can't control. You can control your response. You can control how you use your time and money. But you can't control what happens to you. You can only control the way you respond. And of course, these have to do with like the habits, like the seven habits. Character is all a matter of habit. And in betrayal, the habit, learning to forgive. I can't afford to be resentful of anybody. Resentment is a poison that will eat you alive. I need to forgive the people who've hurt me, really for three reasons. Number one, because God has forgiven me a whole lot of stuff. And if he's cut me a lot of slack, I need to cut other people a lot of slack too. Second, because resentment makes me miserable. It's like shooting people with a gun in reverse and hitting them with the recoil of the gun. The bullet goes in you. It's like drinking poison and hoping they die. Resentment never solved a problem. Some people who are listening right now are holding on to a hurt, somebody who hurt them 10, 20 years ago. That's stupid. They can't hurt you anymore. They can only hurt you if you hold on to it. You need to let it go, not because they deserve it, but because you need to go on with your life. You need peace. You need happiness in your own life. And you cannot be happy and hold on to hurt at the same time. So you have to let it go for your own sake. One, God's forgiven me. Second, resentment makes me miserable. Third, I'm going to need that kind of forgiveness to get into heaven. So for me, as in my form of belief, it's a matter of resentment is worthless.
Rick, when you have wronged someone else and you become aware of it, either over time or immediately, what advice do you give people based on your own circumstance about how to right a wrong, pay recompense, take responsibility?
Yeah. Well, this is good that these come back to back because doctors can say that you could clear out about 60% of the people in the hospital if they knew how to get rid of resentment and get rid of guilt or shame. Those two things combined are the things that hold us back and keep us from really becoming all we're intended to be, that our Creator intended for us to be. Resentment, things other people have done to me, and guilt, things I've done to other people. The answer to both is forgiveness. I need to ask forgiveness. I need to offer forgiveness. I need to accept forgiveness, not because they deserve it. I don't deserve the forgiveness I've been given in my life. But I need to offer it, I need to ask for it, I need to accept it, because it is only in the path of letting go of those things. It's just dumb to hold on to a hurt. Those people who hurt you can't hurt you anymore. Those people you hurt and the guilt you feel about it, and every time you think about it, then there's still a little pain there. Just go and say, man, I'm sorry, I blew it. It was dumb, please forgive me. Whether they forgive you or not, you have let it go.
Rick, as a consequence of the influence that you have built through your book and your curiosity and your brand, the loss of your son was something I think the world knew, and hopefully you feel, your wife and your family feel comforted by, I think, millions of well-intended people. Would you take a few moments and impart some insight into people who may be experiencing a tragedy of similar nature or different, and what did you and your wife and others learn from the loss of your son? I'm guessing it isn't the only tragedy you have suffered or will suffer. Speak to those who have or might suffer tragedy and can come back to this conversation to give them some solace or help.
Well, in the first place, if you haven't gone through a major loss, I'm happy for you, but it will happen because everything living on this planet dies. We live on a broken planet. Nothing lives on and on, you know, in this planet. And so you're going to have loss in life. It is inevitable. It's a Pollyanna-ish. It's a denial of reality to think that you can go through life without loss. So if you haven't had a major loss, well, I'm happy for you. But you need to prepare for it, and you need to understand that grief is actually a good thing. Grief is the tool we use to get through the transitions of life. The people who don't learn how to grieve get stuck at the point of their greatest loss, and they can't get on with their life because they can't get over their life. Now, grief is not something you get over. Grief is something you get through. You go through it, not get over it. There is no expiration date on grief. You can be triggered 10 years later, 20 years later, 30 years later. If I lost my right arm or left arm, I'm going to know it's not there for the rest of my life. I will get through it. I will get on with my life, but I'll know for the rest of my life that arm's not there. My youngest son was born genetically with mental illness, struggled as a baby with clinical depression and as a toddler. He made it until 27 years. He was the most courageous young man I ever knew. He had a close walk with God, but he said, there's just like a claw in my brain that constantly depresses me, makes me anxious, and makes me want to take my life. That'll break your heart as a father. And he made it 27 years before he died by suicide. It was the worst day of my life. Without a doubt, no doubt about it. And I could talk to you for hours about it, but I will say this, that when Matthew died by suicide, of course, I am pretty well known, and it was on the CNN ticker tape. I'm walking through an airport, and I see my son's name, Matthew Warren, suicide. That's gut-wrenching. I would not wish that on anybody. I'm not exaggerating, Scott, probably 35,000 letters of condolences from people around the world who'd read the book, or kings and queens. And the letters that meant the most to me were not from rock stars or world leaders. And I know a lot. I've known almost every president in my lifetime. But the letters that meant the most to me were from people who had been brought to faith through my son and said, yeah, I know your son was mental illness, but he introduced me to God, to Christ. And I wrote in my journal, even broken trees bear fruit, and we're all broken in God's garden of grace. So some things about grief that for those who are going through a tough time right now, you don't repress it. You don't suppress it. You confess it and express it. Men particularly, we're not good at expressing grief. We want to stuff it. We want to can it. We want to repress it and suppress it. That's like taking, Scott, a can of Coke, shaking it up, and putting it in the refrigerator or the freezer. At some point, it's going to explode. It's going to come out sideways in some weird way, like an affair or something, down the road. When my youngest son took his life, my wife and I knew that statistically, a lot of couples and a lot of marriages don't stick together because everybody grieves differently. Grief is like a wave. One minute you can handle it, the next minute you can handle it. The next minute you can handle it, the next minute you can't. And you could go through many of those waves in 30, 60 seconds. Your grief wave, if you're going through it, will never match the wave of your spouse. They will be in grief when you're not, and vice versa. And so my wife and I made a decision. This is 10 years ago when this happened, that we were not going to be a statistic. We were going to let grief drive us apart. One of the things I've trained leaders in all around the world is this, and I'll explain to you what I did with Kay, but this is important to it. The deeper the pain, the fewer words you use. The deeper the pain someone is going through, this is as a pastor telling you who've counseled, I've stood at the graveside of hundreds, maybe thousands of people, bedside of people taking their last breath, the deeper the pain, the fewer words you use. Somebody's having a bad hair day, you can talk to them for 30 minutes. If they just lost a major loved one, you show up and shut up, okay? It's the ministry of presence. People go, I don't know what to say to my friend who just lost his wife or his or whatever, or just got fired, or just went bankrupt. I don't know what to say. The answer is say nothing. Just show up and shut up. It's the ministry of your presence. And so you do what Jesus Christ did. He did give a look, a word, and a touch. A look, a word, and a touch. A look, a word, and a touch. You look people in the eye, which says, you matter to me. The most important thing you can give people is your attention, because your attention is your time, and your time's your life. You can always get more money, but you can't get more time. And so you've got a certain amount of time on this planet. So when I give you my time, I'm giving you my life. So I give you my attention. You look them in the eye. You just say, I'm here. You don't try to say, well, it'll be better, or at least you have this. Those pious platitudes don't work. Just say, I'm so sorry for your loss. I am so sorry for your loss. And then just be shut up. Just be there with them. A look, a word, and a touch. A handshake, a pat on the back, a hug. It's not a sexual touch. It's just a brother, sister, I care about you in compassion kind of touch. And so Kay and I decided that whenever we see each other triggered, and you can be triggered years later by a song, by a smell, by a joke, by a TV show, by a taste of some kind of food, any kind of memory can trigger a painful memory. What we do is we simply walk over. I walk over to Kay, or she walks over to me. We put our arm around them and we stand there and say nothing. It's a look, a word, and a touch. Today, our marriage, we're almost 49 years married now, is stronger than it actually was before our youngest son took his life, because we walked through that valley of the shadow of death together, and we're actually stronger. I also want to say that your greatest contribution to the world will often come out of your deepest hurt. We think people are impressed with our strengths. They're not. They're impressed with how we handle pain, how we handle weakness. That's our greatest, what I would call your testimony to the world. If I were to tell you all the cool places I've got to go and all the neat, famous people I've got to meet, you go, well, goody for you. That doesn't make us feel close. It actually builds a distance, because it goes, well, he thinks he's better than us. But if I start sharing with you about the brain disorder I've had since as a child, and that makes public speaking difficult, and my wife's breast cancer, and all the other problems in life, including a son who took his life, then you go, oh, wow. Well, if God could use Rick like that, then maybe I could be used in the world for good and for greatness. We actually help people when people see how we handle pain.
Rick, thank you for your vulnerability and transparency. There were several moments there where I had to gather myself, remembering where I was in a situation where I just needed to show up and look someone in the eye.
Well, vulnerability is one of the missing elements in leadership. Let me just say it this way, Scott. What the world is looking for today, whether it's in business or religion or government or non-government, NGOs kind of stuff, what the world is looking for is an authoritative message in a humble personality. An authoritative message is, this is the right thing to do. We need to do this right now. But they do it in a humble personality. When you get those two together, it's almost irresistible. That's the Martin Luther King kind of leadership. You know, I had the privilege of, on the 40th anniversary of Dr. King's death, Martin Luther King Day, before I did the inauguration for President Bush, I did President Bush 4 years earlier, for President Obama, I was in Atlanta, and the King family invited me to be the first white preacher in Dr. King's church. That man knew how to have authority with humility.
Rick, as you were talking, I was thinking about how tough it is to be positive in the world today. I was making a list, unfortunately, super easy. The rise of racism, Asian hate, white supremacy, corruption, crime, fights on immigration, anti-Semitism, what's happening with the Palestinians in Gaza, with the Israelis, what's happening with Russia and Ukraine, and countless other hotspots around the world, what's happening with the vitriol of American politics and public service. I read once where the brain is actually wired to be quite negative when you wake up in the morning, that you have to intention yourself to be positive, to choose to be positive. Maybe that's right or wrong. I don't think there's any denying that the world appears to be on fire. And I don't see a whole lot of improvement. How do you wake up every morning not denying these things plus others that I have said and this is a great time to live? There's a lot great going on because there is. Obviously, the press and the media thrive off of the negative versus the positive. We know this. Give us any insights of how to be positive in an era where it just seems there is so much vitriol and hate and venom and fighting and public servants who build their brands around tearing down their opponents and demonizing them and manipulating people. Where do you take that, sir?
Well, it's a brilliant question, Scott. The first thing I would say is you need to stop a lot of the negative input and you need to replace it with positive input in your mind. In your mind, you've got to scale between the negative and the positive. And every time you hear negative, negative, you're dropping pebbles on that side. And every time you think a positive or a good, a compassionate thought, you're dropping it on the good side. Right now, it's you know, scaled against you. It's you're going against culture because everything news is not good news. News is always bad news. If it bleeds, it leads is the name of the theme for local news. And so we constantly hear. No, the first thing I would say, if you want to really make a difference, you're going to have to stop watching so much news on television and the radio, and you're going to have to stop listening to so much stuff on social media. It has become the marketplace of the craziest people. And if you listen to talk radio or news every day, negative, 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 3 hours a day, what? It's GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. That's a saying from 70 years ago, the computer industry. What you put into your mind is what's going to come out. Jesus said it's not what comes out of a man, but what goes in is what comes out because it's in your mind. The Bible says guard your mind. So all I can do is tell you my habit. This may not be a habit for you, but all I can tell you is my habit. I have a personal habit, and I don't talk about this a whole lot, but it's called GWFW and GWLW. That stands for me, okay? I realize we've got a full audience of many different faiths here. God's word, first word, God's word, last word. And here's what I do. I don't do this because I'm a pastor. I do this because I want to be healthy in my mindset. You take a scriptures and you open it and you get it in a translation you can understand and you put it by your bedside and you leave it open. It's easy to ignore a book that's closed. As I'm going to bed at night, what I do is I pick up that and I've just picked a book. I'm making Proverbs, say the book of Proverbs, which Muslims and Jews and Christians would all agree that's a holy book, Proverbs or Psalms. You could pick that one. All would agree on that. That's a lot of people. And what I do is I just start reading, but it's not about how much I read. I read until something hits me. And then I just stop and go, that's all I need. I need to think about that today. So when I get up in the morning, I open and say I'm in Proverbs chapter 4. I just start reading. And when I hit a verse, I go, man, I need to work on that. I need to think about that. That's all I stop. It could be, I could read a chapter. I could read a few verses. I might just read one verse, go, man, that's all I need. And I think about it during the day. Then I leave that open. I leave the Bible, the book open. And then as I'm going to bed at night, I pick it up again, God's word, GWLW, last word. The last thing I do is I read what follows that. And I just read, it might be a few verses, might be a chapter, I might read some stories so it goes longer until something goes, that hits me. And then I put my head down thinking it lasts. I'm filling my mind with positive truth to counteract all the negativity in the world. If you look at the world, you're gonna be depressed. If you, distressed, you're gonna be distressed. If you look at the world, you'll be distressed. If you look within, you often get depressed. But if you look at God's word, you'll be at rest. That's my personal philosophy. So you asked about my habit. That's a habit that I use to help myself because I have to deal with a lot of times the worst in people every day. As a pastor, I deal with people caught in crime. I deal with people caught in unfaithfulness and to their spouse and all kinds of things. And to keep me on a positive, I have to balance that out by filling it with positive truth.
Rick, that was beautifully said. And I want to challenge you.
Yeah.
Because I don't disagree with anything you said. That prescription
yeah.
for mental sanity is, I think, indisputable.
Yeah.
And what I wrestle with, and I'm guessing others do too, is I yeah. feel like it is my civic duty to make sure I know what is going on, is that I know when people that I believe are ill-intended or self-serving, that are campaigning for positions of public service, that are doing the wrong thing, it's my job to stop them or call them out or know what it is they're doing before they gain too much power or too much influence and lead people wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you could take that from a micro view or a macro view, right?
Yeah.
How do you differentiate between keeping your mind whole and clear
yeah.
and recognizing that there are great injustices going on in your communities, in your cities, in your states, in your nation, in
yeah.
your world, and not letting people wreak havoc across our society simply because we chose to put blinders on to keep ourselves in a positive state of mind?
Yeah, I'm not saying that you don't stay aware, that you close a blind eye. I don't believe in that at all. We are to call out injustice. We are to call out racism, which I believe, by the way, is the most common sin around the world. I've been in 165 nations, and what I've discovered is the most common problem is actually racism, where the people in northern Italy don't like the people in southern Italy. In every country, somebody doesn't like somebody else. And I'm getting off key here, but a little bit. Racism is actually an affront to God, because you're basically saying, God, you made a mistake. You should have made everybody like me. The arrogance of that, that God, you should have, I'm the standard for humanity. Oh, really? Who made you the standard? God loves diversity. Okay, let me just say this right up front before we get back to your question. God loves diversity. It was his idea. Did you know that when God made beetles, he made 6,000 different varieties of beetles? Okay, you would have thought 300 or 400 varieties would have been enough. No, God ODs on diversity. He knows every beetle. He knows every beetle by name: John, Paul, George, Ringo, and everybody else. If God never made two people alike and those two snowflakes alike, even identical twins are different in thousands of different ways. The only way we will ever have unity in a nation, the only way we'll have unity in a country, the only way to have unity is to love diversity and not set yourself up as the standard for everybody else. Not set yourself as, God, you should have made everybody like me. Now, let me go back to that other. I wasn't saying don't listen to any news, don't read any news, but you can read headlines and you could read clips and snippets without doing what psychologists today call flocking. And that is, you hear some bad news and then you turn to another channel to hear it again. Then you turn to another channel to hear it again to reinforce that. And it's all a matter of perspective. If you are spending 3 hours a day on social media listening to people racists and anti-Semitics and all these others that we're talking about pummel each other and side pummel each side, if you're doing that, you're just going to fill your mind with it. You have to balance it out. You need less time in Facebook and more face in the book that will give you spiritual and mental health and things like that. So, of course, we have to know what's going on. And, of course, we have to challenge it. We're called to challenge it. But how do you challenge it? The Bible says overcome evil with good. And the problem today, really, Scott, it's a leadership problem. We have a dearth of qualified leaders in so many sectors of society. When you look at politics, you go, is this the best we've got to offer? Really? In the whole world? Is this the best we've got to offer? There's a dearth of leadership. What are the kind of leaders we need? Leaders with integrity, humility, and generosity. I believe integrity, humility, and generosity are the antidotes to the three greatest traps of leadership.
Rick, let's talk about this, because I agree with you. It's a dearth of leadership, and I don't understand it, because never in time have there been more leadership books published. There are more leadership books published than there are cookbooks.
Right.
You have companies
right.
like Franklin Covey, whose missions are dedicated to building
right.
principle-centered leaders throughout the world. You have organizations who like never before, are dumping more and more investments in leadership. They're seeing it as an investment and not as a cost. It seems like in school districts and colleges, we're teaching leadership, but yet we're revering some of the most preposterous leaders in our politics and in our companies. It's almost as if we've never invested more and we've never gotten worse. What's that about?
You know, that's the question of the hour. And, you know, if you can get somebody to solve that question, I will.
Well, if you can't, who can, sir?
Raise your hand. Here's the thing. We have overemphasized talent to the neglect of character. Now, character is really the sum total of your habits. I can't say, for instance, that I have the character quality of honesty unless I am habitually honest. I tell the truth all the time. If I tell the truth part of the time, then I'm not honest. I can't say I have the quality, character quality of faithfulness. If I said to my wife, honey, I'll be faithful to you 28 days a month. The other two are on my own. Partial faithfulness is unfaithfulness. And so when we talk about character, we're talking about the habits of character, the habits of integrity. Now, integrity actually comes from the word integer or integer, which means a unit of one. And what it means is wholeness. Integrity is not a slice of the pie. Integrity is the filling that's in all the pie. Integrity is what you see is what you get. That I act the same way with my grandchildren as I do with the Queen of England. That integrity does not mean you're perfect, for sure. Because if you had to be perfect to have integrity, then nobody's got integrity, because there's nobody perfect on this planet. Integrity means your heart's in the right direction and what you see is what you get. You know, the Greeks, back in Aristotle, Plato's, you know, Sophocles' day, they had Greek plays, the tragedies, and one actor would often wear multiple masks to play different positions in the play. And so a guy would come out and he'd play a certain role with a mask on, and he'd go back, change mask, come out and play a second role with the mask on, and then go back, and then come back and put another mask on and play a role and go back. And that guy was called in Greek the hypocritos. Hypocrite. What do you think we get from that? Hypocrite. And that is, I act one way with this group and I act one with that. When you segment your group, segment your life, you're starting to lack integrity. Now, let me explain this because it's very important. It's a myth that a lot of people don't understand. I call it the Titanic myth. The Titanic myth was before the Titanic, ships just had an empty hull. And if you ran into an iceberg, the hole filled up, the hull filled with water and the ship sank. And so the Titanic was the first ship to actually segment the hull, kind of like they do in submarines today, where you batten down the hatches. The theory is you can take on water in a certain section of your boat and still stay afloat. Well, theoretically, I get it. That's true. You could take on water. But the bottom line is a hole in the boat is a hole in the boat is a hole in the boat, and it's going to take you down. If we're sitting in a rowboat fishing and I start drilling a hole in my end of the boat, and you go, what are you doing? I go, well, it's my life. I'm not hurting anybody else. It's just me. I'm not bothering anybody else. I'm going to take you down with me. And what I'm saying is that my crime or my sin or my fault or my error is never, it may be private. In other words, it's not public knowledge, but it's never just personal. It affects other people around me. The way I live, if I don't live with integrity, it affects other people around me. And so we're lacking people of integrity, humility, and generosity. Humility is another quality that's severely lacking today in leadership because we don't understand it. Humility is not denying your strength. Oh, I'm no good. I'm nothing. I'm zero. I'm junk. You're not junk. God didn't make junk, and you were made by God. So you're not junk. You're incredibly valuable, but you're also flawed. Both of those are true of every person alive today. You have great value and you are also flawed. You're imperfect. And so humility is not denying your strengths. It's being honest about your weaknesses. It's going back to that thing we were talking about, vulnerability. Humility is not thinking less of yourself. I'm no good, I'm not. Humility is just thinking of yourself less. You're so busy with the needs of other people, you don't have time to think about you. And you can develop that habit of humility by learning to always focus on, for instance, I have learned, trained myself that when I walk into a room filled with 75 or 100 people, I don't say in my mind, how do I look? Is every hair in place? Are my clothes okay? I look around the room and I go, who needs encouragement here? I've trained myself to automatically walk in the room and go, who needs some encouragement here? You know, the mission statement of Franklin Covey is to make people great at what they're good at. Great people make people feel great. Great companies make people great. And so that's humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's just not thinking of yourself at all.
In fact, it's to say to Reeds, we inspire greatness in people and organizations everywhere.
That's it.
They determine how they define greatness. Rick, let's close this out. The most peaceful people you know practice what habits in common?
Well, I think a daily time, for me, it's a daily time alone with God. I think you need silence in your life. We're in a world that is anything but silent. It's getting louder and louder and louder, and we're constantly connected to screens today. You need to decompress. You need to decouple. I have a thing that I've taught all my staff, and I've taught literally over a million pastors this around the world. You divert daily, you withdraw weekly, and you abandon annually. This is for long-term. I'm in my 53rd year of ministry, and I'm still going strong. You divert daily, you withdraw weekly, you abandon annually. Divert daily. You need to find something that recharges your batteries. Now, I don't care what it is. It may be playing with your kids, wrestling with them on the floor. It may be playing a piano, playing an instrument. It may be gardening. It may be shooting some hoops. It may be sitting alone in silence as the sunrise comes up or as it sets at night. You need to know what recharges your batteries, because if you have a battery, if your life is a battery and you have one light bulb attached to it, it'll last a long time. You attach two light bulbs to that battery, it'll burn out in half the time. You attach four light bulbs to it, it's going to burn out in a quarter of the time. The people who are listening right now, the kind of people who listen to Franklin Covey show, they got 18 light bulbs attached to their battery. That means you're going to burn out a whole lot faster than somebody who's got one light bulb attached. You need to learn to divert daily. That is, take emotional breaks. And this is actually what we learned from medicine, dosing and spacing. If you go out and you run for an hour in the morning and then you sit in front of a screen for 9 hours, you've effectively neutralized that run. It would actually be better for you to dose it like pills. You to go outside and walk 4 or 5 times a day for 5 minutes to recharge yourself throughout the day. Dosing and spacing is a principle now that psychologists are learning from medicine itself. So divert daily, then withdraw weekly. Withdraw weekly. Now the Jews call this the Sabbath, and it's a good principle. We are wired to work 6 days. And then rest, and you need, our best requires rest. Our best requires rest. So the person who burns the candle at both ends is not as bright as he thinks he is, okay? You can get so many irons in the fire, you put out the fire. And so divert daily, withdraw weekly. You need to take a day off every week. And by the way, I would encourage you, whether you're Jewish or not, call it your Sabbath. Because if you do it your day off, then you're going to cheat on it and you do your honey-do list and you just do more work that you didn't get completed on the other days. You literally need to restore your body, rest your body, restore your soul, your mind, revitalize your relationships. That's Sabbath. Divert daily, withdraw weekly, and then abandon annually. Once a year, you need to totally disconnect. You need to go off on a vacation and not take your laptop. Okay. I mean, I see people, sitting on the beach in beautiful places around the world, still connected. That's not a vacation. They have not decoupled. Divert daily, withdraw weekly, abandon annually.
Rick, at 100 million copies sold, the Guinness World Records accuses you of having the second most translated book in the world in history, next to the Bible. On that, what's next for you, sir?
Well, I'm not one of these authors that feels like I have to write every year. I get a good book out about every 10 years, and I only write when I feel like I've got something to say. There is a glut out there, and I could, you know, since I'm a public speaker and since I have literally 10,000 messages that I've taught, I looked the other day and found that in my own staff at 43 years as pastor at Saddleback, I had taught over 1,000 messages on leadership. Well, there's a glut out there that if I had something special, I'll say it. But I will say that the next book that's churning in me, and it might take 5 years or longer for it to come out, is a message on hope, because people are feeling so hopeless in personal ways, in society ways, all those mentioned things that you mentioned that are discouraging about our culture. We need a good dose of hope.
Dr. Rick Warren, you are the founding pastor of Saddleback Church based in California. Your book is, of course, the number one New York Times best-selling book titled The Purpose-Driven Life, What on Earth Am I Here For? Thank you for your time today, sir. Very generous of you.
Thank you, and God bless all of the people who are listening today, and may you have a great week. God bless you guys.
And we'll see you back here next week for a new conversation on leadership.